Okay, so welcome again to the universe for this, our third podcast from the mighty cricketmanwales.com, or I'll be honest, it might be bowlingatvincent.com, a multinational corporation, because I haven't decided where to post this one yet. Today I am welcoming the very distinguished sports journalist, Mr. Ian Herbert. Herbs, you are alarmingly welcome, mate.
Great to be here.
We're going to ramble over loads of stuff, but inevitably, can we start with your journalism thing? Tell us a few about the hows and whys. So how or why did you get into sports journalism, specifically maybe, as opposed to novels or whatever?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I wanted to be a news journalist. I wanted to sort of find out stuff, you know, about the world, stuff that was wrong or whatever about the world.
Yeah.
And I worked for about 10 years in regional papers on the Liverpool Daily Post, and then I moved into the Nationals with the... I joined the Independent as Northern news correspondent. So covered a lot of big cases, really. Big court cases, big crimes, disasters, mayhem, all that goes with being a news reporter. Great days, really, in many ways, especially the further you go back, the more it was that you'd start work in the morning and you would actually spend a day digging around on something. It would be published the next day.
Okay.
And you'd have those 9, 10 hours or 8 hours to find your story, get to the bottom of it and publish it. Whereas now things are very different in that the minute anything sort of happens, someone's written about it within 20 minutes, so everything's written very quick. So I think in a way, to the detriment of accuracy a lot of the time. I think most journalists would agree with that.
Okay,
however, that's neither here nor there.
So
I worked as Northern correspondent in the Indy for about 7 or 8 years.
Do you want to put a date on that?
Started in 89 on in Liverpool, worked 10 years till 99 on the Post. I was deputy editor on the Post in the end, did a little bit of the editing side of it. Started on the Indy in 99, and in 2007 I moved from news across to sport, really because I'd felt that it was a bit like I'd done it for a long time. It felt like the same annual stories were coming around. It felt a bit like Groundhog Day, and sport really I felt was more, offered more, just a lot more interest and a lot more space to write. And, you know, the sport is the new religion, really. It was then and it is now, and there's a lot more potential to kind of, I suppose, build a profile writing about sport. And I've always been a big football fan. I'm from a village called Weston Rhyn, which is near Chirk in North Wales, and always been a massive Wrexham fan with my brother Pete. Watched them loads over the years, and I suppose watched a bit of Premier League. Never been a massive Premier League follower, but there's obviously that interest in sport and feeling that you inherently know a bit about it, and it would be good to write about it.
Okay.
Brilliant.
I just want to stop because I'm quite interested in this idea of, you know, well, the question probably is, did you then choose to go into sport, or was it an opportunity that just happened? Because there is this, you know, I think a lot of us do loads of different things and then by accident find maybe what should be our route A.
Accidental, totally. Job came up on the Indy as a Northern football correspondent, and I went for it and got it. I was very much in two minds about it. To be honest with you, Rick, I'm still in very much in two minds about whether writing about sport is the way to be a journalist. I sort of still feel, probably now more than ever, perhaps for things we might go on to talk about later in the podcast, I sort of feel that news reporting is really where it's at, you know.
Right.
I mean, as my great former colleague James Lawton, chief sports writer of the Independent, called it, you know, sport is slightly the toy shop of journalism in many ways. You know, we go to football games, we try and find some stuff out around the edges about sport, but, you know, especially in the age we're in, with, you know, with Brexit, with you know, kind of spectacular lack of good governance in the country, and with so much change ahead, you sort of feel, well, you know, news is probably where it's at more than ever in some ways. So I wouldn't say I'm feel like it's my calling to write about sport. However, the news, I spent quite a lot of time in recent years doing a bit of talking to undergraduates and postgraduate journalism students. They all really want to go and do sports journalism degrees, and I really call them against that. I say, look, do a journalism degree, learn how to be a news reporter, and then apply that to sport, because sport is armed to the gunnels with press people, with comms managers, with the people whose job it is to actually keep you from the truth and to confect a story about sport, especially in the Premier League.
Yeah.
So it's our job to try and, get underneath it. Yeah. And it's a little bit like reporting the Vatican sometimes, or reporting, you know, the Soviet Union pre-89. There's a hell of a cloak of secrecy around it.
Yeah.
So.
But it's, I tell you what, it's really quite refreshing to hear you say that. And I do want to talk about this, definitely, the whole thing of the impenetrability of the Premier League in particular. And I don't even want a single football out necessarily for, you know, major flag. But I think it's there, quite rightly. And, yeah, so we will go on to talk about that, please. However, because I'm sure people who are listening might be really interested in the sort of Paisley era, Fergie era, et cetera, et cetera, because you were right there, okay? And again, specifically, you've written a book about Paisley.
Yeah.
So let's just stick with the Liverpool, Man U, Man City thing for a minute,
if we could. Yeah, yeah.
Tell us a bit, about the book.
Yeah,
why
so,
Paisley?
Yeah.
Why that subject? Yeah. Now, who did you get access to whilst doing your research and your writing?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, well, good to have a chance to talk about it. Yeah, so I wrote a book called Quiet Genius, which is a story of the biography of Bob Paisley, who'd never really been given very detailed treatment, I didn't feel, biographically. The Liverpool journalist John Keith had done some great stuff about Bob, but I felt there was some more digging around to get into some of Bob's players hadn't really talked about Paisley, and I just wanted to understand not so much why Paisley had succeeded so much, which is what had been written about a lot by John and others, but why? What allowed this very quiet, avuncular, uncommunicative weirsider, Bob Paisley, to win the European Cup three times with Liverpool and to win so many league titles? And Bill Shankly had been written about so much.
Yeah, of course.
And there was this kind of assumption in everything that was said about Bob that Paisley, who succeeded Shankly in 74, had really sort of taken over Shankly's great team and almost just settled into his shoes, and it was just almost like, you know, keeping the shot going on.
Yeah.
Which is absolutely bollocks, actually,
frankly,
because Shankly never won the European Cup.
Right.
Shankly's Liverpool teams did okay in Europe, but they never won anything. They were a little bit over-ambitious and naive in Europe, and Paisley won an awful lot more. In fact, he won more trophies per season than Sir Alex Ferguson. So, and actually, Paisley was not around when I arrived in Liverpool in 89. He retired as Liverpool manager in 83.
Okay.
By 89, he was very much in the sort of twilight of his life, really. So it was just that as a kid growing up in North Wales, we'd read the Liverpool Post. That was the paper we used to get back in North Wales in those days. And I was a Liverpool fan and wanted to know, well, what was it about? Why did he succeed? So
okay. So who did you interview
some of the players. I mean, one of the interesting things about Paisley was that he was a hard bastard, really, if I can say that on Universe Podcast without bleeping me out. He was a hard bastard. He wasn't particularly kindly to his players, despite
this
avuncular image that sort of went before him. So not all of them wanted to talk about him. Some of them who were his chosen players, like Graham Souness, for example, Alan Kennedy, Phil Neal, those who sort of flourished under him and played year after year after year, Phil Thompson, all were phenomenal. Souness in particular, brilliant, brilliant stories.
Yeah.
Souness, probably the player Paisley admired more than anyone else.
Okay.
However, there were players who were on the margins for Bob, and he wasn't very good about communication with the players who were on the margins of his team. Steve Highway, for example. Steve Highway, who's never done a book and never been interviewed that much, but is a very intelligent guy,
still involved
in Liverpool Academy. He was a brilliant interviewee, although I don't think he realised he was going to be. He just sort of said, well, I'd had no relationship with him, why are you asking me? But, you know, people like David Johnson and Jimmy Case and Highway, who, you know, weren't treated well, didn't have a great deal out of Bob, were good. And then others who, you know, who were big-time people, celebrity people like Alan Hansen and Kenny Dalglish, who didn't want to talk. But that's because they're big, rich celebrity people, and that's the difference between them and some of the others, really.
And so, the modern era, maybe.
The modern era, they're sort of part of that modern era, so their prerogative.
Yeah. But Paisley then was, you know, tough, kind of funk, you know, because... So, how, what I'm trying to get at, in a way, is, or work out myself, is So where? How come he was so inspirational? Yeah. Well, yeah, or no, how come it was a phenomenal
That's what I was trying to drive at. It was difficult, I think. And what I've come to, what I came to, which is why I sort of called it but quiet genius really was in some ways, was that he wasn't a communicator. Right. He wasn't a great sort of inspirational manager like a Clough or a Shankly. But he was very good at actually delegating and embracing the people around him, the football men around him, like Joe Fagan, Ronnie Moran, Roy Evans, Tom Saunders, this group of guys who, like him, were obsessed with Liverpool, obsessed with the game, watched games endlessly, reserve games, youth games, and they formed the boot room. And I mean, that was one of the original and probably the most supreme example of a sporting collective.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
And now these days, we're talking all the time about, you know, empowerment and kind of, you know, applying management theory to the way we coach. The reality of it is that ego is more than ever part of what is management's about. You know, Sir Alex Ferguson retires as manager. David Moyes comes in, wants all his own people, all the United backroom staff go, all that kind of, with the exception of Giggs, really, all that kind of, you know, collective intelligence from the great glory era goes.
Yeah.
Klopp comes into Liverpool, he brings his own people in, he doesn't really want people from back and from the back of beyond.
Okay.
Guardiola, most certainly, you know, it's almost like a, Manchester City is almost like a Catalonian state within a state now, really. Right. You know, the chief executive is a Spaniard.
Yeah.
Guardiola and all the others around him. So, whereas Paisley, he'd been at Liverpool for many years, since just after the Second World War, and you know, he actually quietly allowed other people to have their say. And sometimes, you know, if you're managing with Bob, he would say to you, what do you think, Rick? Who should I pick this week?
Yeah. Okay.
Who should I pick for that rare spot at number 8 because Jimmy Case is injured? And you might say something.
Yeah.
And it might be the wrong, he might in his heart think, well, maybe that's wrong, but he might go with you because he wants to, he believes you might have something that he hasn't in terms of intelligence on that player.
Yeah.
So it was about, I suppose it was just about how quietness, lack of ego, collectivism, a kind of socialism, a lack of the big time Charlie. They hated the Liverpool team, that Liverpool management team. They hated bombast, they hated pomposity. There's still a lot of that in the city of Liverpool. There's still a hatred for that of any big time Charlie mentality. And that, I think, is what, quite hard though it is to define, is what made it. Quietness, almost, Bob's quietness was almost helped to make things as good as they were.
Yeah. And kind of radically different to what we've got now in many clubs. And can we, if we stick with this, you know, this northern collective of giants, and the word again that comes to mind is monsters, in a way, in that this everything seems so kind of ego-driven and so distant from ordinary you know, families. I grew up in a football family very much, you did, I know, you know, and yet quite a lot of us, I mean, I'm confess this, absolutely, I've drifted from the football generally quite a lot.
Yeah.
And some of it is to do with kind of cynicism on the pitch, and we'll talk about that maybe in a minute. But quite a lot of it is this, the fact that clubs are financial monsters and they work in a sort of abstract land which I can't identify with it on any level. And actually, it kind of distances me. It makes me feel kind of like I don't care anymore.
Totally,
you know, I'm not drawn to it in the way that, you know, in some ways, and sorry, it's sounding like some kind of Victorian reactionary in a way, but some of that is to do with behaviour on the pitch and stuff like that, as well as, you know, Mourinho's behaviour. Let's go with Mourinho for a minute, because obviously you've had contact with... I personally, you know, I'm a part-time Man United fan. My grandfather played for him. I've got a strong link there. However, you know, I find it quite difficult to support them at the moment at any level because of Mourinho and how he treats people like you, you know, as well as his players.
Yeah.
Because he's so kind of narcissistic and so, it's so much about his own ego. Tell us a bit, if you can do it, about your contact with him, or where, you know, how typical or different to Klopp or Guardiola that is, or is there a theme going here that these guys are beyond us, beyond our, you know, laws and...
Yeah, well, I mean, less contact for me with Mourinho in the last year. I was up with The Independent, say, until last year, and then I joined the Daily Mail and Mail on Sunday as a sports writer, because The Independent really, as I knew it, had gone. I mean, the print edition had gone. the website doesn't really bear much resemblance to what the print edition was. So I sort of, and on the mail, I'm actually doing far less of that week to week, seeing the managers. There's a big team of staff who do that.
Right.
However, I think, you know, I think I could certainly say that I think what you get with Mourinho is certainly narcissism, but it's also kind of just a real dour sense of just a negativity about everything that's going on in his world, really, in some ways.
That's weird, isn't it?
Nothing seems good.
Spirit
nothing seems
crushing
right.
Is the
yeah,
word.
Spirit crushing. It must be for his players, and of course the problem with the way that I think, you know, football journalism's gone. You know, even in the last 5 years, you know, there's this obsession with reporting of what the managers say.
Mm.
So so many stories really are about what he says, and when, you know, he comes up with some kind of statement or something which sounds slightly controversial, where it's just him playing games with words, really. But it just always gets reported as and that is the big story or whatever. So that seems to come to the fore above, you know, anything else, and it's reported straight, you know, rather than kind of, well, he said this and this is what he said it and what he meant was. I think quite a lot it just becomes the story. So and actually it's impossible to, and they're all so adept at the media management now that, you know, you try and challenge them as you know, as they are often challenged about, you know,
right,
and that's quite difficult.
I think we feel like that's not happening very much. And
yeah, I think it is.
It's probably
yeah,
wrong.
No, I think it probably is happening. It is happening a lot more than you might think. It's difficult to challenge because you know, you've got with Mourinho, you've probably got about 9 minutes before of his weekly press conference before that press conference is cut off by his press secretary. You know, she'll call a halt to it. The actual daily newspapers component of his press conference, that's the stuff that the questions that the daily papers ask, and that information is embargoed, held back for the newspapers and won't be everywhere beforehand, so it has some degree of originality to it.
Okay.
That particular section, the daily newspapers questions, probably about 4 or 5 minutes tops. So if you ask something which kind of pisses him off, then you can ruin it for everyone. You know that there's a slight risk of that. He doesn't generally walk out, but it can certainly affect the, you know, his capacity to talk in any way about the football. But nevertheless, you know, people are challenging him week in, week out. But, you know, these people are very adept at kind of dodging the question. They're politicians, you know. They're operators, really.
Yeah.
That's why what you see in black and white is probably a sort of a little bit of a riddle, really. So he says this, which is in relation to that question, but what does that really mean? You're having to sort of piece together very short answers from a guy who's pissed off that you've asked him the question in the first place.
Sure.
So
he's in a very kind of protected environment,
yeah,
in a way. And,
what is different between Mourinho and Ferguson
penetrate.
Is that, yeah, exactly. What is different? There's two things that are different between Mourinho and Ferguson. I mean, Mourinho doesn't generally ban journalists as Fergie did. I mean, if you asked Fergie a question he didn't like, or you wrote something he didn't like, he would ban you,
mm-hmm.
which is obviously, you know, infringement of, you know, the right to go and report the club, etc. He was famously, you know, banned me 3 times and colleagues many more times.
How did you get back in? Because we talked about this.
Yeah, I mean, generally the way it certainly worked in one experience for me was that, you know, and I think others may concur with this, that, you know, the editor would have to write to Ferguson apologising in some sort of way or kind of prostrating themselves before him, and he would then call up the editor to see him, and he would then want to really basically bollock the editor for what the journalist had written or asked. But then generally, more often than not, it would pan out to be a conversation about football. Fergie loved talking about football with people who knew quite a lot about the game, and then you would maybe get back in. So there was that with Ferguson. However, what I would say is the difference between him and Mourinho is that the conversation with him was very interesting. You know, he'd got this vast perspective going right back.
Yeah.
You know, his football knowledge, his intelligence, his kind of sense of perspective was so sweeping in a way that, and when he had something, and he always knew what he wanted to talk about and was willing to talk about, and in a sense you might as well have just said to him some mornings, look, what do you want to talk about?
Yeah.
Off you go, because if you'd ask him something slightly, you know, in his ribs, and he just bat that away and then talk about what he wanted to talk about anyway.
Okay.
However, that you never, I don't think I've ever been in a Mourinho press conference where you actually get that sense of, wow, here's a football man
who loves the game.
Who loves the game, who's giving me a sense of perspective of the game that it's just a little bit of, it's just verbal jousting at best, really.
Okay. Fab, thank you. So let's go back to players, right? Because again, one of the things that's made me drift is, daft example possibly, Vardy, right? Just off the top of my head. Vardy, quite often, is charging it in the box, and I know as a former player, who played up front or in centre midfield, blah, 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 very different level, except that, but that Vardy's thinking is very much about running across the centre half to draw a foul or a pen, or, you know, leaving his leg behind somewhat to draw a foul or a pen. Shearer, in the same situation, it's not much before, he's thinking, right, I'm going to smash this baby right in the top corner. You know, he's thinking goal.
Yeah.
And And that's just a kind of, an abstract example. In other words, players are looking to draw fouls, pens, yellows, reds. You know, for me, that's insulting to the spirit of the game. Sorry, sounds corny. All that stuff, yeah. And there are zillions of examples of that every week from different players from all over. Neymar, obviously famous in the World Cup. Insultingly, you know, embarrassingly anti-sport. What, you know, how do you view that? Anything we can do? How do you think we could...
I'd say... It doesn't really. I don't feel as angry about. I don't feel as concerned about that as you do. I don't feel as concerned about it as some people do. I do think that one of the benefits of the Premier League is, and of it being a global league, for all the things that we've lost, is that, you know, there is some phenomenal football. There's some phenomenal skill. I mean, we're obviously in Pembrokeshire now. I've been here, sort of not covered the football the last couple of weeks, but I did cover Arsenal, Man City before I came away, and you know, Raheem Sterling. What a privilege to watch him play for 90 minutes. So I think, you know, you know what you get with one, you lose with the other. I think it's far more part of the culture of the game than it certainly was. Okay, so, you know.
So maybe
I mean, but I just think some people are concerned about, and that really is the first thing that a lot of people will want to talk about in terms of the modern game. Don't feel it madly. I think there's sort of certain things that have been done to try and resolve it, i.e. it's become a yellow card offence. I think, you know, when the more that VAR comes in, the more that will be seen and that will be dealt with. I think VAR is a good thing. I think it did a lot of good stuff at World Cup, so I think things are going to get better in that respect.
With, and again, my, you know, the obvious one that many of us fans talk about is, you know, retrospective bans for clearly when you've clearly tried to con the ref or you've invented something or whatever. Now, that seems a bit of a no-brainer. I mean, view on that?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, why shouldn't you...
A little panel maybe with three former pros on it or something,
totally,
maybe.
Absolutely. Although I think probably, you know, VAR will resolve it in the fullness of time if they can kind of get the glitches of that technology sorted out or the way it's handled sorted out. That seems to me like a better way of doing it, because I must say I've never given that a hell of a lot of thought. I guess the slight problem with having that dealt with retrospectively is that, you know, it's a lot of kind of more bureaucracy and faff to have to kind of get it dealt with after the event, really. But I suppose it would deal with it. I mean, if people know they're going to get done for diving, then, you know, albeit retrospectively, then they won't do it.
Okay. Yeah. Fair enough.
Yeah.
Listen, because we've already said that, we could talk for hours, about many, many things here.
Yeah.
Let's just go kind of round up-ish by coming back into the sports journalism thing, or journalism generally, because it is in a very different place to what it was when you started your career.
Yeah.
Thoughts on that broadly, if you like, but with this, you know, maybe this angle that, the new, you know, what does the digital age mean for newspapers, for sports journalism maybe in particular? Paywalls, you know, freelance work, what, you know, how do you see that for you or
there's just absolutely no doubt about it that digital is the future, and that is the way that the vast majority of people are consuming news now. I think if I were going to look on it optimistically, I would say that I hope that the way that things have evolved are such that there has been a time where, you know, it's really all been about clicks, about generating headlines and introductory paragraphs that will make someone click on the story, and that beyond that, the actual material is baseless. You know, either the story is actually fundamentally untrue or wrong, or
right.
you know, and you know that they'll deal with the legal ramifications after the event, or they'll deal with the ramifications of people thinking that that's rubbish after the event. I hope that we've gone through that kind of sort of shitstorm, if you like, of clickbait,
yeah.
to a phase where I think people now do really value reporting, you know, not fancy writing per se,
okay.
not kind of clever talk per se, but actually, for me, the journalism, you know, working in news for many years and now in sport, has got to be about providing a couple of facts or three facts in a commentary piece that mm-hmm. that no one knows about. So you right. actually find something new out by discovering it, you know, by yeah. reading that sort of piece. So I think there is evidence that, you know, people do want longer form stuff, which tells them more. I mean, just on the football side, you look at something like the Blizzard that seems to me to be still very successful. I don't know
yeah.
how the actual numbers stack up for Jonathan Wilson with that, but it's still a brilliant publication for my money, where you can read a 10,000 word piece on an aspect of football or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, I believe that all our work should be behind a paywall, of course, because I mean, if I'm a plumber and I've arrived at this house to fix the sink, I'm not expecting to do it for nothing, you know. And if
yeah.
if I'm a football manager or a cricket manager, I'm not expecting to do that for nothing. But somewhere back down in the midst of time, someone thought it was an incredibly good idea to just give everyone's material away for nothing.
Yeah.
The model being that people would crowd in to advertise around it, and that would make it commercially viable. Well, sorry, that was an absolutely spectacular, you know, kind of
balls up
because yeah. it just hasn't happened, basically. So. Okay. I also think that there are a lot of people. I think the BBC has encroached very much on, with its public subsidy, on the space that the media organisations covered. I think, you know, BBC okay. does what, you know, why is the BBC cutting back in other ways when it's doing full on match reports and, you know,
covering
the written
everything.
Word? I don't really think that's its job. I think okay. if I'm going to yeah, say a priority for the BBC, I would say there would be other things.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I think ultimately what's quite interesting and quite fortifying for reporters and commentators like us is that although there's an absolute vast sea of content out there, there's not actually that much which is really delivering new information, you know, on a regular basis. And I think, you know, when you tweet out stuff or connect to or link to stuff that does have new perspective or new info, people respond quite positively to that. So I think people still see the need for that, really.
Okay.
For new
okay.
information.
Brilliant. So. Listen, I'm kind of happy to go on for another 2 hours, but I'm going to draw yeah, it to a close okay. just yeah. because people might be yawning out there. I don't know. I'm going to say thank you, mate.
Yeah, no, great to be on the podcast.
Sincerely.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've got no doubt at all that you will find a way, whatever the way of journalism tends to be, you'll be all right, mate. Thanks
Good.
Again.
Yeah, nice to be on. Cheers.
Cheers.